This week on the Best of Flashpoints, highlights from another week of wall-to-wall coverage on the ongoing massacre in Gaza. Our senior producer, Nora Barrows-Friedman, reports from the Israeli-occupied West Bank, a discussion with British documentary filmmaker and journalist John Pilger. Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance gears up to deliver 5 tons of desperately needed medical aid to Gaza. Canadian rabble-rousing journalist and activist Judy Rebick is arrested at the Israeli consulate in Toronto, and The Knight Report. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Robert Knight are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And now from exile in New York City, The Knight Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Knight Report and War Summary, Willie Peter is in flaming Gaza amid allegations that Israel is once again using white phosphorus incendiaries in the most crowded city on earth. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The U.S.-backed Israeli bombardment, invasion, and occupation of the Palestinian Gaza Strip descended deeper into controversy today with multiple reports that the Israeli Army and Air Force are now employing white phosphorus shells in their assault on the planet's most congested civilian population. White phosphorus is an explosive, flammable chemical weapon characterized by slender, smoky trails of the hyperincendiary element, which burns white hot, causing burns to the bone on its victims, with its particles embedding themselves within the flesh and reacting irreversibly with the moisture and oxygen therein. Over the past 24 hours, there have been multiple news photographs of what appear to experts to be phosphorus shells exploding both as airbursts and at ground level, as depicted in a downtown street photo of southern Gaza City by AP photographer Bernat Armangieu. Additional photos from the London Times and other sources further show the jellyfish-looking tendrils of phosphorus plumes streaming from multiple airbursts over Gaza City. Israel is, as of deadline, officially denying the use of white phosphorus in Gaza. However, Israel also issued early denials of its use during the 2006 bombardment and invasion of Lebanon, denials that were later nullified by admissions that white phosphorus had indeed been used there. The United States also used the inflammatory weapon, known in military circles as Willie Peter, during the Vietnam War, as well as in its 2003 invasion of Baghdad and the ensuing 2004 assault on Sunni patriots in the occupation-resistant Iraqi town of Fallujah. Because of the horrible deaths and irreversible wounds white phosphorus inflicts on civilian victims in crowded urban areas, the compound has been banned as a chemical weapon by most military states. The Geneva Treaty of 1980 forbids the use of white phosphorus in civilian areas with a loophole, countenancing its use as a smokescreen or for illumination. Yet, the photographic evidence available thus far includes Israel's putative use of the incendiary in broad daylight, where it is unnecessary for illumination, and at high altitudes, where its use as a smokescreen is also of dubious military value. However, Israeli Captain Ishai David issued an ambiguous verbal smokescreen earlier today, stating only that, quote, Israel uses munitions that are allowed under international law, end quote. Nevertheless, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee today called on the United States government, Congress, and the international community, including the UN and the Red Cross, quote, to investigate Israel's reported use of white phosphorus in its ongoing attack on Gaza, end quote. And the Times further quotes former British Army Major Charles Hayman as saying, quote, white phosphorus is also a terror weapon. The descending blobs of phosphorus will burn when in contact with the skin. If white phosphorus were deliberately fired at a crowd of people, someone would end up in The Hague, end quote. Israel is technically a signatory to Protocol 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibit and restrict the use of incendiary weapons on civilian populations. Tel Aviv's arsenal of white phosphorus is provided by the United States in the form of the M110 and M101 white phosphorus shells that are able to be deployed in Israel's 155mm howitzers, which have been steadily pounding the Gaza Strip. And that's some of the news of this Monday, January 5th, 2008, from exile in New York. I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
From the Israeli-occupied West Bank, a report from our senior producer, Nora Barrows-Friedman.
Okay, I'm here in Beit Omar. It is about 1 p.m., and the Israeli military came a few hours ago and blocked off the main street. There were demonstrations called all over the West Bank against what's happening in Gaza, and the Israeli military has sent up reserves for most parts of the West Bank, along with border police, to be here because the regular military is, of course, bombing Gaza at the moment. I am on the second floor of a house. You can hear the rocks being slingshotted by some of the youth here in the village. There are at least three houses, possibly four, that the Israeli military has taken over, and they're now perched like snipers on the tops of roofs. You know, this is the Israeli military versus kids with stones. One of the journalists here said that the Israeli military said that if kids throw stones, the Israeli military will shoot and kill them. So it's very tense right here.
They shot gas.
That's tear gas. Oh, I can see it. It's landing on roofs. They're going right over our heads, the tear gas. These kids are expert stone throwers. Some of the slingshots are fashioned out of rope and nylon string with a little basket to hold the stones. And the Israeli military has at least four armored personnel carriers and jeeps, loads of M16s, taking sniper positions on top of families' roofs. These families are barricaded inside their homes now with the Israeli military on top, using their home as a sniper post to shoot children. Wow. That sounds like live ammunition.
Yeah. Nice. Sound.
Sound bombs. We're on one of the side streets, so I can't tell what's happening in the main part of the village. So there are soldiers now coming into different positions. Some of them are leaving the roofs and coming onto the street and shooting. You can hear. Okay, we were just shot at. Oh my God, okay. It was a rubber-coated steel bullet. I have it in my hands. It broke the glass on the door that I am standing near, right through the glass, and they're aiming again. It's very tense. It's just a spray of these rubber-coated steel bullets. They're like little balls. They weigh about, I don't know, maybe 2 ounces. Can you tell me what's going on right now?
Soldier shoots the... They make a plan to catch the people and to shoot them.
But these people are kids. They're children.
These kids. And they don't care for anyone. Now they try to shoot us. We are on the roof. What's my fault? He tried to shoot me in my head.
It was right at head level.
Yes. Look at the window here. Look.
Yeah, it's only about 5.5 feet. And they shot right through the open door here that we're standing right up against.
Yeah, look. Look at
that. Was a sound grenade?
Yes.
There's broken glass all over the floor where I'm staying. I'm gonna go inside. There's our friend Becca Wolf of the Palestine Solidarity Project. And Becca, tell us how many kids, I'm recording this right now. Tell us how many kids you can see right now.
There were about 50 or 60 kids at the beginning, but they've spread out between houses and in different areas, so it's hard to say exactly how many. The soldiers seem to be shooting rather in accurately. What we were noticing when we went behind one of the buildings is that these are obviously reservist soldiers, and they're not used to using tear gas or other kinds of so-called less than lethal weaponry, and so they're just sort of shooting them in between houses relatively randomly. Another, one of the police jeeps, the border police jeeps, has just driven up the side street, sort of revving its engines, probably trying to scare the kids out of the way.
How old are these kids?
You know, I would say that they're ranging in age from 12 to 17 or 18. There are probably a couple of older guys around, but that's the general range.
And how many soldiers and jeeps are there right now?
There are soldiers on top of at least four houses that we know of, each house having four soldiers at least on them. And then we've seen soldiers driving around in four other jeeps. We were told earlier that they had brought in big armored personnel carriers and unloaded lots of soldiers that had spread out throughout the village. So it's very hard for us to know exactly how many there are.
And Becca, when we were shot at a few minutes ago, you were on the ground. We're up on the second floor terrace, and the rubber-coated steel bullet was fired at us, and it made this like 3-inch in diameter hole in the glass of the door, like 2 feet away from where I'm sitting. Can you tell us exactly from your perspective what happened there?
What happened was there was a group of soldiers that were standing around the corners holding their backs up against a wall. And so they knew that you all were on the terrace, that we were on the ground in front of you. But one soldier very quickly whipped around the corner and aimed what was actually a spray of rubber bullets. I can see the casing. I'm standing in front of the area where they shot from right now, and I see the casing of the bullets. What it is a canister that uses basically an explosive to propel a group of five round, and they're not even rubber coated, these are plastic coated steel bullets, a ball of steel with a covering of plastic that's not more than a millimeter thick. And so one of those was the one that went through the window of the house who is hosting you right now, and the others bounced off in a couple of directions. The problem with this kind of weaponry, obviously, as they demonstrated, is that it's incredibly inaccurate. It's used as so-called crowd dispersal, something that can injure people.
God. Okay, so I can see right now there are soldiers passing you, going up the street. You're just about 100 feet away from me, but you have a bird's eye view right now.
Basically, running back and forth as though they're in the midst of southern Lebanon. So what they seem, what their, you know, real so-called enemy is, are teenage boys throwing rocks from, you know, 50, 60, 70, maybe 100 meters away. So what they're doing is running back and forth across the street, taking cover next to the houses, and then firing up amongst the buildings where they think that the rocks are being thrown from.
Okay, Becca, I'll just be here at my post, you're at your post, and we will check back soon.
Sounds good.
All right, be safe.
All right, thanks.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 soldiers.
Nine.
For what reason they decided to do this today? We're about 100 feet away from the soldiers. Can you hear some of the sounds of the kids up the street? Jesus. Wow. Okay, soldiers are coming towards us now.
Hala, شو اللي سوتوه؟ شو اللي سوتوه؟
ما عشيت بوتر ما عشيت.
What are you doing?
جربت بانيشي مش مرقبول وزرق بانيشي.
English.
Do you speak English?
Yeah.
You do?
What?
What are you doing?
Now.
What am I? I'm sitting right here. You shot our window right there. You see?
Okay, who has the guns here? Do these kids have guns? No, you are the ones who have the guns. So what are you doing here? With your guns, shooting people's houses like this. What are you doing?
20 minutes ago, here.
Children, yes, so why are you shooting at them? No, these were children. Do they have guns? They don't have guns. What do they have? They have stones. What do you have? You have jeeps and tanks and bulldozers? This is, you're not supposed to be here. This is an illegal occupation. Go home. Go home. Why are you walking away from me? Because you know I'm right? Look, I paid for that gun. Those are my tax dollars. I'm from the US. Put it down. That's my gun. Put it down. You are not supposed to be here shooting at these children. Are you crazy? Go away. These are people's houses here.
I hope you will have a nice weekend.
I hope you do too. I hope you can sleep at night knowing that you're shooting at children.
She sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? This just another day in a dirty war. When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed? One more home destroyed.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the expanding ethnic cleansing of Palestine by Israel. As we just reported, in the last 10 days, over 540 Palestinians have been killed, and at least 107 of the dead were children. Over 2,700 people have been wounded. Joining us for some deep background on the current situation and the history is internationally renowned filmmaker and award-winning journalist John Pilger. Pilger has already made two documentaries on Palestine called Palestine is Still the Issue. We note that in 2008, John Pilger presented Gaza-based Palestinian reporter Mohammed Omar with the prestigious Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism. What happened after Omar received the award and attempted to return to his home in Gaza is an indication of what happens to journalists, particularly Palestinians, when they try and tell the truth about Israel's illegal occupation and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Omar, a special correspondent for Flashpoints, was arrested, beaten, and tortured by Israeli security forces. The treatment of Mohammed Omar, while brutal, is not untypical of the way in which Israelis attempt to restrain and repress any information about their brutality, and it continues as they expand their land war and air war over Gaza. John Pillager joins us now to talk about what's been going on in Gaza. Welcome, Mr. Pillager, to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be on Flashpoint again.
Good to have you with us. Maybe we can begin by having you respond to claims by the Israelis, which I'm sure you've heard before. They justify the current invasion by saying that they have already ended the occupation of the Gaza Strip, but it didn't stop Hamas from attacking Israel and threatening the security of the Jewish state. Your response?
Well, they didn't end the occupation of Gaza. The bundling out of the so-called settlers several years ago was a charade, because what it allowed the Israeli regime to do was to secure Gaza as a giant prison camp, to lock its borders, to lock its airspace, to lock its beaches, its access to the sea. So a million and a half people are very effectively imprisoned. And there, the screws, once the settlers were out, the screws were tightened. What Israel has been doing is effectively, and we have all the reports from the International Committee of the Red Cross to the United Nations and many others, Israel has been starving the population, refusing to allow food trucks to come and go, refusing to allow humanitarian aid, refusing to allow fuel and other important commodities to come and go. At the same time, it has stolen Gaza's water. People there have no power, and this present campaign has absolutely nothing to do with Hamas. All this Israeli action happened long before Hamas came to power. The irony is that the Hamas government is the Arab world's only democratically elected government. Of course, that is thoroughly unacceptable, that popularity to the Israelis. What the Israelis are doing in Gaza is a continuation of what they started to do over 61 years ago. And now that the Hebrew archives have been opened, and that historians of the likes of Avi Shlaim and Elan Tappe and others have revealed the ethnic cleansing was a deliberate long-term policy that was implemented in the 1940s before Israel became independent. It started with an infamous project called Plan D, in which almost 400 Palestinian villages were ethnically cleansed and their populations murderously forced out. And that basically is, in a nutshell, what the strategy, the so-called strategy, has been ever since that. It is to get rid of the Palestinian population. That's very difficult to do. It's an indigenous population. To get rid of them, they've snaked a wall through the West Bank. They're now terrorizing Gaza. One can only think that the outcome of this, in their terms, is to further fragment the population in order to control it, put it in sort of so-called cantonments, and finally to expel those so desperate to get away from this, expel those into Jordan. I speculate there. I don't know. But it's quite clear getting rid of the Palestinian population is the reason for this. It has absolutely nothing to do with Hamas.
Everybody claims, and this is on every mainstream outlet in the United States, that it was Hamas who recently violated the ceasefire after the official ceasefire was sort of ran out, and that it was Hamas shooting missiles into Israel. That was the first violation that led Israel to invade. Now, I know you said this is long before Hamas, but you know what I'm talking about here in this specific...
Yeah. Well, you know, trying to understand Palestine, the tragedy of Palestine in the United States, is an intellectual, moral, and almost cultural feat. How, you know, thank goodness there are programs like yours. Thank goodness there are programs like Amy Goodman's and others that are independent. Because otherwise people would know absolutely nothing in the United States. And I must say, I pay tribute to the many Americans who, almost using their own critical intelligence, and we look at the latest polls to see this, that believe that Israel should make peace with its neighbors. That's been the public opinion polls in the United States have said that time and again. I really don't know how people get their information, because the media on Israel and the Middle East is totalitarian. It's worse than anything I remember in the Soviet Union, and I reported the dissidents in the Soviet Union. It's absolutely worse. And this nonsense about Hamas breaking ceasefires, as if this is suddenly some event that has just happened, and there are two countries called Gaza and Israel. In fact, you know, the rather pathetic response that the government of Gaza has come up with, these rather homemade rockets, very inaccurate rockets, and they've killed a number of civilians, and that's to be deplored, a tiny number compared with the industrial killing. Five children again today, the industrial killing by the Israeli forces. Now, Hamas didn't break the ceasefire. These ceasefires are instigated, invariably. They were back in the days of the PLO. Hamas has instigated probably more ceasefires than all the other Palestinian groups put together. It offered a 10-year truce to Israel. But, you know, if you look back at the history, and of course this history has no place in the American media whatsoever, you will see the kind of what the Israelis called a trigger, a provocation. This happened in 2001, where there was an agreement between the two enemies, if you like, on the Palestinian side, Yasser Arafat's PLO and Hamas. There was an agreement between them for a ceasefire, not to send in suicide bombers, to conduct a truce regardless of the provocation. And the Israelis had a problem with this because they couldn't provoke them. Finally, the one thing that provoked them was the assassination of the Hamas leader. And that, of course, then was what Israelis called a trigger, got the response and allowed the Israelis to go in massively. And that's exactly what has happened here. On November the 29th last year, the Israelis killed six Hamas fighters. In fact, Hamas fighters, everyone is a kind of Hamas fighter. They were civilians, but several of them were apparently attached to one of the Hamas military units. Six of them were killed. That was the first breach of the ceasefire. Hamas responded to that, and it's that response with rockets that is characterized in the American press as being Hamas's initiative that started all this thing. It's a complete lie.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with journalist, filmmaker, documentarian John Pilger, who has reported extensively and done several films on the illegal occupation of Palestine by Israel. We are hearing now, Mr. Pilger, about the use of unconventional weapons in one of the most highly densely populated, if not the most highly densely populated places in the world. We're having reports, our correspondents are talking about strange smells, white flashes that turn the night into day. We're hearing about other kinds of bunker busters, new hot off the press, if you will, bombs that were shipped to Israel in September. Your response to the use of unconventional weapons, are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised. I couldn't say if they're being used or not because I don't have hard evidence of it, but the U.S. used phosphorus against civilians in Fallujah. And what the U.S. does and Israel does are interchangeable. Israel used depleted uranium in its assault on Lebanon in 2006. It used cluster bombs. Cluster bombs were the worst. Cluster bombs which have now been banned by most of those countries that have stockpiles of them, with the exception, of course, of Israel and the United States. Children are still picking up these clusters and losing a limb or losing their lives. Traces of depleted uranium have been found all over Lebanon. So it would be no surprise at all. It's very difficult to describe to your listeners Gaza. I mean, Gaza is a few miles long and about a mile wide, I suppose, and it's got 1.5 million people on it, pushed really with their backs to the sea. People are forced to live in walled compounds, several families in one of these compounds, so everyone is packed together. 50% of the population are children. So, you know, every attack with these monstrous weapons is attack on a group of humanity of whom half are children. Do we really have to put up with this nonsense about strategic targeting of Hamas security sites and so on? The place is running with kids. Wherever you go, there are kids. They're lovely. They're everywhere. They're kicking what passes for footballs, you know, bits of things they've stuffed together to try and make up a football around the streets. They run after you. There's lines of them going to school, all beautifully dressed in their school uniforms. I'm always impressed in Palestine, the emphasis that parents put on education and seeing that their children go off to school looking almost as if they live in a normal society. That's why the Israelis bombed the university, because they've tried for years to destroy that will to educate in Palestine. So it's a prison of children. They're the ones out in the open. So when these helicopter gunships come over, and these monstrous F-16s, with the bomb you mentioned is 1,000 pounds, called GU-395 or something or other. Yes, the Democratic Party control Congress in September approved the sale of these so-called, quote, cost-effective bombs to Israel. They approved them, and they must have known that they were about to be used. Everybody knows. Why is Mr. Obama silent? Because he knows, he knew, and he approves of it. This thing was planned as the Israeli press, and the Israeli press is highly informative, unlike the press in the United States and to some degree in Britain, particularly the newspaper Haaretz. They have disclosed that this whole assault was planned 6 months ago. So nothing happens of this nature, of this magnitude, without the coordination with and approval of the United States. And that would be the White House, the president-elect, and the Congress. So I think it should be called an American-Israeli attack, not simply an Israeli attack.
Flashpoints was just invited into a meeting with a couple of local Palestinian leaders here, and we met with Dan Brunell. He's the district director for the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and we raised the issue, and I did, regarding if Pelosi knew that these weapons that were shipped over in September would be used against Gaza, and would he or she be aware that this could be part of a prosecution for a war crime, because if you supply the weapons to use on a civilian population, you are a party to a war crime. He took notes and he seemed to have very little information about this. What about war crimes? 15 mosques, several schools, as you said, the university was hit, apartment buildings, government buildings, one police station, 70 young men who were training to be cops were killed. Does this constitute what you understand to be a war crime or a crime against humanity?
There's no question of that, Dennis. The whole operation is, by any measure of international law, whether you take the Nuremberg Standard, the Geneva Conventions, the whole apparatus of international legitimacy and law, if you measure not only this operation, but everything that has gone before it, the use of food as a weapon, the degradation of civilian infrastructure, everything is aimed at a civilian population. It is a major war crime against humanity. I was about to say prima facie war crime against humanity, but does anyone really looking at the evidence suggest that it isn't? Listen to Professor Richard Falk, the international law expert at Princeton, who is the United Nations special reporter for the occupied territories. He says as much. We have so many sources, experts on international law, who say this. I think what is most shaming of the respectable media is that it reports the lawlessness as if it is lawful. Israel is the world champion violator of international law, and I'm not saying that as a as some kind of rhetorical statement. It is. It has defied more United Nations legal directions, both from the Security Council and the General Assembly, than any other nation since World War II, and we can throw in some of the worst dictatorships there. Israel holds the record for international lawlessness. The occupation of other people's lands, of the dispossession of people, of war against civilians, and so on and so forth. And you could take any of the conventions, as I say, from Geneva right through to Nuremberg, which is meant to be the gold standard of international law. And what they have done and what they are doing now is a crime. And they're only allowed to get away with it because they are backed by the so-called superpower. At the very least, they'd be forced to live to begin to explore ways of living in peace with their neighbors.
They also would have a lot more difficulty getting away with it if, in fact, there was an open flow of information. But that's where we started. Our correspondent, Mohammed Omar, was tortured after you gave him a wonderful award for his courageous reporting. The Israelis make sure that there isn't any information so that they can make it up as they go along. Don't we in the media have a real responsibility here?
Yes, we do. And the intimidation of journalists and of journalistic broadcasting organizations especially, with this constant threat of will start abusing you as anti-Semitic if you offer any criticism. You know, it's a kind of, that itself is a profanity. But it's worked. That said, I have to say that my sense of public awareness is growing. Israel does not have the immunity, the public immunity, that it had some years ago. And I think that changed with its criminal assault on Lebanon in 2006. And I think it will continue to change as a result of this assault. Unfortunately, while our awareness and consciousness progresses, innocent people are dying.
Well, that is a fact. And Mr. Pilger, we thank you for taking the time out to speak with us about a story that you have covered for so many years. I know that so many people are heartbroken, and people inside Gaza are beyond heartbroken. They are facing imminent death. They are fleeing, but there's nowhere to go. It is always at least helpful to get some good information on the record to give people something to work with. So again, we thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoints.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Dennis.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, as you heard earlier in the broadcast. And as you know, if you've been listening to this show and alternative sources, this is a humanitarian nightmare, a crisis that is getting worse every day. Barbara Lubin has been in the middle of this for many years. She is heading out, representing the Middle East Children's Alliance, meeting up with some people, supporters in Egypt, and bringing some 5 tons of aid desperately needed there in the Gaza Strip. Barbara, thanks for coming in. I know you have a lot going on. First of all, before we get into what you're bringing there,
I'm going to say a lot going on.
What's your gut reaction to this latest slaughter?
It's, as the two young men just said, it's a total nightmare. It's a disaster. The UN has called it a disaster. And I, you know, I'm not the only one leaving tomorrow. I know the listeners know this, but, you know, I'm going to the south and Nora's going to the West Bank. And you're going to be hearing it from both, all over, both of our experiences. I'm flying tomorrow morning, and I'm going thanks to all of the hundreds of people in the Bay Area and all over the United States who have given us so much money to buy, who have stepped up to the plate to help us buy. It's actually 4.5 tons of medicine in Holland, and that's being shipped to Cairo tomorrow, or on Friday, actually. And we're taking another $100,000 to $150,000 with, I'm taking it, of Mecca's money. And a lot of the money, some of this money, a big piece of it, was raised by the folks in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where my friend Sharon Wallace lives. And Sharon's coming with me. We're meeting Dr. Mona Elfara, our project, Mecca project director in Gaza. We're meeting her in Cairo. We'll be purchasing medicine and loading up the 4.5 tons of pediatric medicine onto trucks, and working very closely with the World Health Organization and also with the Red Crescent to try and get it in through Rafah. it's very doubtful whether I would be able to get in or Sharon. We're only hoping that Dr. Mona can get in. But most important, we're hoping that the people from the World Health Organization who will be with us on this long trek will get the medicine in. That's first and foremost.
And of course, Barbara, as you said, we're going to keep in close touch to you.
Yes,
and
we are.
Nora Barris Friedman, who's the senior producer on this show, who is going back for,
her 800th time.
I don't know. She's always going, and she's going at the right time to be on the ground on the West Bank. You're going in, as you said, through Egypt with Dr. Mona, who has already suffered a great loss. I believe her cousin was killed.
Her cousin's house in Rafah was bombed, and the house collapsed on top of her, and she died. Yes. So, and this is not the first thing that's happened to Dr. Mona over the last year. Her mother died of natural causes when she was trying to go back there after she was speaking in the United States last year, and she was forbidden to go to the funeral. They wouldn't let her in. The Israelis would not let her in until after the funeral. What is happening in Gaza? You know, it's been 60 years of horror for Palestinians. But nothing, I think, has touched what's going on today in Gaza. I think that this is the bottom of the barrel. The indiscriminate killing of children and women and men and old people and young people, it's unconscionable. I'm very proud of all the young people who have been in the streets in San Francisco, all over the world, people demonstrating. There's been a remarkable change in the world. I remember years ago, Penny and I calling for demonstration, and maybe 10 of us would be there at 5th and Market Street with Answer, a couple other people. Nobody came. And now there are thousands of people in the street, and it's young Palestinians who are in the leadership, as it should be. That's very exciting to me. We have to always remember there's all kinds of work that needs to be done, the political work, but most important, we must continue to beat our elected officials over the head. We must stop all aid to Israel. None of this crap about stop military aid. Stop all aid. This is genocide. This is outrageous. Not a nickel of American money should go to that state for what they have done and what they are now doing. And I just want to say I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I'll be there on Thursday, and I don't know what to expect. I have no idea what it's going to be like at the Rafah border. But I'm really very grateful to be given the opportunity by all the people who have sent money to us to be able to go and do our share. We are going to be continuing to send medicine into the Gaza Strip for a long time. We need your help.
Both in the West Bank and the Gaza
Absolutely.
Strip, between building centers, art centers, and centers of learning, and centers for disabled kids and stuff like that.
That last report mentioned Nusrat Camp. We have a project there. They mentioned the UN school. We have a water project there. I have no idea what's happening to any of our projects. Jabalia Refugee Camp is a primary place where we have worked for 20 years in Gaza. And I'm hearing
that
now,
was being bombed while we were talking
being
to
bombed,
our correspondent.
The Rachel Corrie Center that we helped build there, all
bombed.
Of it.
All right.
If people want to respond, want to help, it's the MeccaForPeace.org, MeccaForPeace.org, MeccaForPeace.org.
Well, we're going to be talking to you from Gaza.
From Rafah. And hopefully from
heading.
Gaza.
We're looking forward to that. Barbara, thank you very much.
Thank you,
everyone. The courage, the work is crucial, and you really are an example on the story that got me interested and knowledgeable about. Thank you for that. Thanks, Nora. She's on her way out.
Love just one nation. And the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people in now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it in the peace.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Protests to the Israeli attacks by air and land of the Gaza Strip are happening around the world, continuing every day. Now we head up on Flashpoints to Toronto, where several activists were arrested at the Israeli consulate, sitting in and protesting the ongoing bloodshed. And joining us is one of those protests and an organizer for the protest, Judy Rebick. Welcome to Flashpoints, Judy. Tell us about what happened today, where you were, and why you were there.
It was a group of Jewish women that met last week and talked about what could we do to make it clear that there were Jewish voices in protest of what Israel is doing. We had a big demonstration here on Saturday, about 12,000 people, but, you know, the media is still framing it as, you know, Arabs versus Jews, and we don't think that's what it's about. We think it's about an aggression against a defenseless people. And so we decided that we would occupy the Israeli consulate. So that's what we did. We went in one at a time. We're all Jewish women or Israeli women. It's a diverse group of women from 25 to 65. We went in one at a time, and then at a certain point, we announced that we were protesting, and we refused to leave until Israel leaves Gaza. The security guard in the council had tried to drag a couple of people out very violently, and I protested him and told him we'd charge him with assault if he kept it up, and he should call the police. Then an RCMP officer came in, and once the RCMP officer came in, the security guard stayed out, and after that, we were treated okay. Then the Metro police came, the Toronto police came. We were there, I guess, all told about 2 hours chanting and singing. Then the Toronto police arrested us for trespassing and causing a disturbance. They handcuffed us, with our hands in the back, and they took us to a paddy wagon, which was probably the worst part of the experience, and we were in the paddy wagon for about 45 minutes, and then they decided just to let us go. They didn't charge us. In the meantime, we had, from the consulate, we had, you know, Twittered and Facebook and all that, so we had lots of supporters there when we came out.
And you actually just got out of the paddy wagon or the police wagon.
Ten minutes ago, yeah.
Do you feel, did the arrest sort of maybe dissuade you from doing this kind of action, or are you ready to do this again?
I think that, you know, in general, I mean, I've been an activist my whole life, and in general, I don't think getting arrested is for the sake of it is useful. But in this case, I think we have to ramp up the protest to let people know that this is not, you know, some debate, that people are dying, children are dying, people are dying, and they're going to die in huge numbers if we don't stop it. And so I think that we have to do things that make people realize that this is, what's going on is extraordinary. We have to take extraordinary measures. I'm a very well-known public figure in Canada. I used to be a journalist. I was a television host. You know, I'm a writer. I haven't been arrested since 1973. That's why I decided to do it, and that's why all and the other women never been arrested, because we just feel that what's going on is so unacceptable, so terrible. We have to denounce it, and you know, especially in the United States and Canada, you know, people covered up by saying, "Well, you know, Israel has to protect itself." Well, we think that's crap. Sorry, I get excited, you know.
No, I understand. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, you know, as you were pointing out, the Israelis say they have the right to defend themselves, and so does the U.S. President. Barack Obama, the new administration, has been rather silent on this. What was the dialogue like inside the Israeli consulate there in Toronto? Were people angry with you? Did you try and talk to people?
Yeah, we tried to talk, but they just closed the windows, and the staff, you know, closed themselves down, and the security guard was very aggressive toward us, and he wasn't willing to get into a discussion with us. We tried, but he said, this isn't about politics, and we said, yes, it is about politics. You know, they just wanted to keep it at, you know, that what we were doing was illegal and we were going to get arrested, and we said, well, what you're doing in Gaza is illegal, too. And so, that's how he answered, but he didn't want, you know, the cops didn't really want us to talk to them.
And so
he was very angry.
You said that the security initially tried to rough you up and drag you out?
Yeah, that's right. And two people. They went after the youngest woman, and I protested, and he let her go, and then he tried to grab a camera from one of the other women, and when she held it, he slapped her in the face.
Really? The security guard slapped her in the face?
Yeah.
Did she get that on the camera?
Unfortunately, we didn't get that on camera, no.
All right.
We only had 7 witnesses. I don't think he's allowed to slap her, but by Canadian law, he's allowed to remove us from the premises. So, Yeah.
Where does this go for you now?
Well, you know, it's not like there's not lots happening. Like the Palestinian community organized a big rally on Saturday, and it was huge. It was one of the biggest rallies we've had in Toronto in a long, long time. It was 12,000 people. So the ongoing organizing is happening, and there's going to be a Jewish rally here tomorrow, a pro-Israeli rally, and we wanted to get our voices heard that there are Jews who don't agree with this. And not just the activists, but other people. You know, we had a filmmaker there, a professor. We had a housewife. You know, people who don't normally participate in protests, but who feel very strongly about this.
Finally, Judy, as a former journalist and a television host, I'm not sure, I haven't followed the Canadian press, but this story is essentially cleansed out of the mainstream in the United States. And as you know, this is really a war by two countries against Palestine. The U.S. at $15 million a day and advanced weaponry is very much a part of the war. Are you shocked at the cleansing of the story?
Yes. I mean, I'm not shocked. You know, the American media has a megaphone for the Pentagon for a long time, you know, for a number of years now. So it's not shocking. But, you know, Canadians were shocked by our government. Our government is even more hardline than Bush on this. You know, they're saying, you know, like today, yesterday when the school got bombed, our government blamed Hamas for the bomb of schooling. Didn't even hold the Israelis responsible for killing 40 people in a UN school. So we're pretty shocked by our own government's complicity in this. You know, we're used to the American complicity, but Canada, you know, is usually taking a better position on Israel, you know, more balanced and supported the Palestinians in many ways. We have a new right-wing government now, and it's clearly just following Bush's line. And once Obama gets in, you know, they may continue to follow Bush's line here. So that's another reason we felt it was important to really protest, because of our own government.
And just focused very specifically, doesn't the press have a responsibility? And in fact, if they do not inform the population, they become enablers for this kind of expanding
ethnic cleansing. I mean, here, you know, we have like the Globe and Mail, which is like our New York Times, saying that Israel's used appropriate force. I mean, it's an outrage. It really is an outrage. I mean, here I think the reportage is somewhat better than in the States, because we have CBC and they tend to be a little more even-handed when it comes to Palestine. But, you know, the issue of the American support for Israel and the fact that Israel couldn't be doing what they're doing without the kind of money that the U.S. government gives the Israeli military, this is never spoken about in the mainstream. And it should be. I mean, there should be investigative reports about this, right?
All right. We have been speaking with Judy Rebick. She just was released from custody. She was arrested inside the Israeli consulate in Toronto at a sit-in to protest the expanding attacks against civilian populations in Gaza, getting very bloody. Thank you. Judy's a writer, former television host, activist, and I guess you're pretty angry. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music breaks: David Rovix, The Death of Rachel Corey, Yosef Islam, Where Did the Children Play, and Michael Fronte in Spearhead with Bomb the World. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.